WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
With me now is Garrett Brown, who has changed the way movies are made. His invention, the Steadicam, straps onto the camera operator and balances on a suspension system that eliminates the wavering that you get with a handheld camera. He received the 1978 Academy Award for Technical Achievement for this invention. He's not only the inventor of the Steadicam, he's the most accomplished operator of the camera. He was behind the camera in its movie premiere in the film Brown for Glory. For the film Rocky, he ran with the Steadicam behind Sylvester Stallone up the Art Museum steps. More recently, he shot the rope bridge sequence in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom and the forest sequence in Return of the Jedi. He shot virtually all of Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. In between flying around the world to do tricky Steadicam shots for feature films, Garrett Brown has developed a new revolutionary camera called the Skycam. The Skycam is suspended in the air by wires and is remote controlled by computer. The camera can hover from several inches to several hundred feet above the ground, and it can fly up, down, and across at speeds up to about 25 miles per hour. The Skycam was unveiled in the fall of 1983, and it's since been used for network coverage of sporting events and for sequences in the feature films Birdie and Slugger's Wife, a film soon to be released directed by Hal Ashby. Before movies, Brown's career was advertising, and he still does some radio and TV commercials with his partner Ann Wynn. Their comic improvised Nichols and May-style spots for Molson's Ale and American Express have been acclaimed by the advertising industry. In Philadelphia, they also can be heard on radio and on TV in their ads for WIOQ Radio, which are also short comic character sketches. Although you hear their voices, you never see their faces on camera. Garrett Brown lives in Philadelphia. Garrett, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's great to see you again.
Thanks, Terry.
And congratulations on your Skycam.
Well,
let's talk about the Skycam in a few minutes. I want to, for our listeners who haven't heard you before, introduce them to the Steadicam. I'm sure they've seen your shots in movies. Can I ask you for a brief description of the Steadicam?
Well, you actually did very well. The problem is a handheld cameraman inevitably shakes the camera because human beings are always in motion, hopefully. The Steadicam deals with that problem by isolating the camera from the cameraman. This object that he's lugging around is actually held by a sort of mechanical arm, which is attached to a strange-looking suit that the cameraman wears. And the mechanical arm is like a spring sort of suspension system. It just tunes out all the bumps. And then the camera itself is arranged in a sort of fundamentally stable shape. It's basically, you know, lengthened and made taller and just made more inert. Sad to say, it's an invention that barely works. I must report, it takes a good operator. I mean, it's like saying the violin works to make wonderful music. In the early days, we peddled the Steadicam as if any bag lady could pick it up and make wonderful shots with it. It turns out that it takes a lot of practice and so on. So as inventions go, I wouldn't say it's a triumph of inventing. It's somehow a triumph of things that work with people, like the violin or the skateboard or the blood pressure measuring instrument, if you will.
I can't imagine why you invented it, because it overcomes problems that I'd imagine you really didn't have to deal with since you weren't shooting for movies then.
Well, actually, I was producing commercials, and I owned a dolly which weighed 800 pounds. And I can tell you that having lifted that up and down onto a pickup truck a number of times, I was very interested in finding another way of making moving shots that didn't involve the old-time way of doing it. There's nothing in the traditional film gear that the average citizen of Carthage wouldn't feel right at home with. I mean, a dolly is a wheeled little truck, and the camera sits on it, let's face it.
Are there any classic film sequences that you'd like to reshoot with the Steadicam?
Oh, I'd love to have worked for Hitchcock, I can tell you. I mean, I missed seeing Rope this time around, but there are shots in that film, and there are shots in many of the old Hammer films, wonderful English productions, and in the 30s in Hollywood when the dolly was an art form. The camera had just gotten re-liberated by the soundproofed camera rather than the camera in a little room sort of concept. And they went mad, didn't they? I mean, the sets were designed with walls that flew away silently, and grips would leap in and move the furniture so that the director's elaborate choreography could work. Well, we've lost, I think, some of that skill with the dolly. When you move on to location, you know, you can't fly the walls away, and it's, you know, the furniture is real, not made of cardboard. And So actually the camera, I thought, had been getting more static over the years as we pushed out into a location medium, you know. And I never thought there should be, in effect, a reason why the cameraman should be any less mobile than the people he's shooting, you know.
What were some of the first sequences that you really tested the Steadicam for a movie?
Well, for a movie, I was thrown in headfirst, just, you know, hurled right into the water on Bound for Glory. My first shot on a feature involved 900 extras and a 46-acre set, and there I was up on a crane, you know, trembling out of just pure nervousness and funk, you know, looking around me. And fortunately, they didn't make the shot before lunch, and I had a couple of beers at lunch and calmed down a bit. But I remember the operator who was looking over my shoulder at the time and who is now a cameraman shooting a Spielberg film, and he and I were just talking about this. He said, "This thing must work," he says, "because you're shaken and the image is still, you know." And I'm sure he thought perhaps the way it worked is it made the cameraman shake. And, you know, it was very funny, though. So from testing it in private and doing commercials and running around, we had an Arnold Palmer commercial to do, and we couldn't get them to agree to keep the thing secret. And so we shot the commercial in the conventional way, and then when Palmer went home, we ran around the golf course in the twilight and tried it out, you know. It's that kind of thing. I mean, the whole process is quite bizarre, inventing something mechanical like that anyway. Most inventions these days are black box transistor things, aren't they, you know? And people forget the heyday of the mechanical invention, the lunatic inventor going by on his machine or, you know, seen riding up the elevator to the patent attorney's office with his glasses with a windshield wiper. It is a bit strange, you know.
What were some of the typical requests that you got when the Steadicam was first available from directors who realized that the Steadicam could liberate them to achieve certain shots that would have taken weeks to set up beforehand?
Well, some realized it right away, and some saw it as a stunt tool. Some were quite happy with the conventional way of making films, and except for the shot like running after somebody or running up and down steps. My God, I did more than my share of shots running after people and leaping up stairs and jumping over gaps and things and impersonating rushing POVs, you know, and all that. And there were a few people, Avildsen among them, who saw more than that in it and who used it for liberating the process of filmmaking as much as liberating the shot, because the process involves a lot of paraphernalia, doesn't it? It involves all the laying down of rails and equipment and so on. And there are my favorite Steadicam shots are ones that on screen you wouldn't know the difference. You know, they are just a traveling camera. They involve putting the lens where somebody wants it, that's all. But you wouldn't look at it and say, oh, wow, what a shot. What you don't see behind the scenes is that shot was made in a flash, instantaneously. You walk in, you make it. Wait a minute, let's change it here. Let's curve, S-curve out here and do that. Well, you can't do that with a dolly, you know. And that is great fun, I'll tell you. To imitate the traditional dolly shot with extras, you know, but not have it be a big deal. I mean, after all, at my age, I'm not promoting the running up and down shot. I'm sort of saying, hey, let's do something really sophisticated.
You shot the sequence on the rope bridge in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Yeah, there's a case where, you know, that's the only way to get a camera moving out there that doesn't look terrible. I mean, a handheld guy, if he felt the way I did on that bridge, would have been quivering even more than normal.
Can you describe the scene and the shot that you were asked to do?
This bridge was built by a company that makes dams, and they're a pretty rough and ready outfit. They built a real suspension bridge 350 feet in the air. Yes, it had steel cables inside the rope, you know, dressing cables, and it had boards on it that were allegedly very strong and so on, but there were big gaps between them. If you didn't walk with your feet straight ahead, your foot would go right down between the boards. So that implies also that you could see down between them, and that was not a treat. I can tell you to look, you know, down 350 feet as you're lurching on this thing, and it was violently in motion. Every time Harrison ran across it, it would lurch up and down a couple of feet. And he even actually went through one of the boards at one point, and there was a great hoo-ha and uproar and finger-pointing about who put that board in and didn't test it and so on. His leg went through it, and fortunately his other leg stopped the rest of him from going through. But that happened just before I went out to do my thing, so I had no great, you know, confidence in this bridge with me and my extra 50 pounds of machinery, you know. It was scary. And then when all the local extras dressed up as soldiers started to run, each of them lurching about, the thing was airborne, you know.
But how did you
hold on? It was hot, by the way. I held on with one hand and operated with the other. And my toes, I trained my toes to hang on to the boards. I mean, it was bad.
Doesn't that bridge get blown up, too?
Yes, I declined to be on the shot when it was blown up.
Are there scenes that you decline from because they're too dangerous?
No, very few. Usually, everybody agrees, generally, you know, what is too dangerous and what isn't. There have been very few. The only time I ever really made a fuss about anything was we had a shot potentially to walk up the cable of the Brooklyn Bridge for a film called Wolfen that just ran the other day on television. And without inspecting the cable, and my memory of a bridge cable is it's the size of a truck and it shouldn't be any problem and so on, I said, well, all right, I'll do it, but we have to, I made some conditions. We've got to, you know, rehearse it for a day without the pressure of production. I want you to hire a mountain climbing type guy to go with me to be sure that I'm shackled and tied up right and so on. And I said, I'll try it. And due to the pressure of production, they couldn't lay on that extra day. So I said, well, okay, I will not walk up the cable and shoot. But in fact, I ended up walking up the thing anyway, holding the, you know, with the gear in a backpack, and we shot on top of the bridge. And I made very sure that everybody knew that the only way I would do that is if I was tied with a rope to a big iron ring that I spotted in the middle of the top of the bridge on a rope just short enough that I couldn't inadvertently go off the edge, because you get enthralled with shooting and a gust of wind comes up and bye-bye, human and sewing machine, head for the drink, you know.
There's been some tragic deaths in Hollywood recently, stuntmen getting killed, and then the deaths on the set of The Twilight Zone. Has that given you pause about
risky
things?
I've always tried. I mean, in the very early days, I was somewhat crazy. I mean, I would run down a steep talus slope and just backpedal and stop right before the edge and so on. I don't do that anymore. And I teach a great number of people to do the Steadicam. In fact, I'm certain probably not the best in the world at it anymore, because I have a number of other souls who are known jokingly in the business as the living masters. And these very expensive bodies are extremely good at it. But we've all, you know, I've taught most of them, and one of the emphasis is, you know, to do it safely. I mean, I have not lost anybody yet, thank heavens, and I hope I don't, you know.
I'm speaking with Garrett Brown, and he's the inventor of the Steadicam and of the Skycam, and we'll be talking about the Skycam in just a couple of minutes here on Fresh Air. You also did the sequence in Return of the Jedi in the forest where these crazy creatures are driving on some kind of motorized vehicle.
Speeder bikes.
Speeder bikes, yeah, like through the trees at amazing speed. And I kept wondering how you managed to do that.
Well, I trained and trained, and I managed to run 130 miles an hour just for short periods.
Did you really?
No.
No, okay.
No.
I'll believe anything.
Are you kidding? You've been in this business too long,
that's
Terry.
Right.
You've been told too many outrageous things by too many people. It's clear.
Okay, so now you can tell me how you really did it.
The way it was done was sort of a film trick. And actually, I loved this job. I had a wonderful time. First of all, I like the tough ones. I like advancing the art a little bit. And this was a first. I got a phone call. Do you think it's possible if you were to walk along with the camera running very slowly? The idea was maybe one frame every second, okay? Well, now, if you project that film at 24 frames a second, you have sped up what I did 24 times, clearly, okay? So 24 times 5 miles an hour walking speed, let's say, is, you know, 120 miles an hour. Can it be held steady enough so that it won't look like it's vibrating and bounding around and so on? And my guess was yes. And the way it was done was quite a tour de force, really, because I had to walk through the redwoods about 1,000 yards carrying this thing, but the place that it was pointed couldn't deviate by a fraction of a degree from one side to the other, nor could its height, nor could its side-to-side position, nor could my speed, nor could its roll attitude. And the way we positioned it was we strung an invisible green thread through the woods and pulled it taut. And as I walked along, I just kept the camera within an inch or so of that thread, which is so tiny in the vast scene of all that you couldn't see it. And then I aimed the thing with a very long telephoto sort of side finder video camera. And I would aim it at a handkerchief or something 1,000 yards away and try and keep that in the lens with a very long lens. And now, of course, if that's still in there, then the overall angle hasn't changed much. But it was frighteningly precise work, because if I let the thing sink a foot, let's say it took 5 seconds for it to fall a foot, well, then there would be a third of a second severe bump in the shot once it sped up. So living in that kind of time expansion is extraordinary. We even tried one shot with a live-action actor who was told, and he was told nothing else, he was just told, do this action at a 30th of normal speed. Well, it's hopeless. I mean, no one can do that. He was supposed to slice. He was a stand-in for Mark Hamill. He was supposed to slice away with a sword at a 30th of speed, and he looked like a grandmother dressed in the Mark Hamill costume that had by mistake gotten away and having a palsy attack in the middle of the shot. I mean, it was grotesque.
How many takes of that sequence did you do?
Well, we shot a lot of that. That was on, I think the sequence ran nearly 5 minutes. And I shot, of course, the background plates, so-called, and then the optical fellows matted in all the speeder bikes in the foreground. I supplied the backgrounds at high speed. And I think I must have made 14 or 15 shots in different places and probably did 3 or 4 takes apiece.
When you work for a film that is directed by someone like Spielberg or, with Lucasfilms, and you have all this money and special effects at your command, is it easier to do the movie? Does that help? Are you aware of that when you're doing your shot?
Well, there's in some ways it doesn't make any difference by the time you get down to the Steadicam operator himself. I mean, it's like saying, would it be easier for a first violinist in the Philadelphia Orchestra than for the same in a string quartet? There are good things and bad things about a big unit. But basically it's the same. As long as he's got his hotel room and his transportation and his meals, then the rest of it is irrelevant. I sometimes make a lot of use of the unit's, many grips and electrical guys and so on if we have a tough thing to do and I need something fabricated to walk over and then it has to be struck and so on. But generally, I like shooting in little units as much as big units. The large unit has a truck full of dollies and cranes anyway, just lurking there, taunting me, And my object, of course, is to get all the shots and just rule them right out. But in a small unit, frequently you go out with none of that, Only you, just lurking there with your magic little machine, And it's fun.
Some of the shots that you do have actors in them, and you might have to do some really tricky choreography. But it's up to the actors, too, to make sure that they've gotten the scene well, performed well, gotten their lines right and everything. Have you ever wanted to strangle an actor because you did your part and you got through this really tricky, long shot and they didn't perform well in that scene, and because of that, you had to go through all that choreography all over again?
Well, I think with all due humility, I must point out that the actors are lumbered with the idea of having to do 3-minute scenes all through a set because I exist. And I'll give you an example. George Scott in, what's the name of that film? Brando was in it and Scott, and had to do with oil machinery and machinations and so on.
Right.
I'll think of it.
Yeah, I know the one you mean.
He was wonderful, and he had a 3-minute scene to do, descending many staircases and walking through the City Hall in Los Angeles, a scene that normally would have been shot in cuts and would have taken a couple of days, but now George has 3 pages of dialogue to do. And you can imagine the look of dismay on the face of actor or, grip or anyone else in the set when somebody blows a line, or if I make a mistake 3 minutes in, I could cause him to have to do 3 minutes of giving his all and, the ultimate performance again because somebody wants it in one take, I'm not crazy about that, to be honest. I mean, to me, the cut is a noble institution. I love cuts. Audiences are used to them. I mean, I'd be happy to shoot all of it, but I like doing it in short pieces just like an actor does for the same reason. You can concentrate on the piece, make it perfect, But when we all have to be spectacular for 3 minutes in a row, it's rough. Kubrick used to insist on numerous passes on shots like that ran 3 minutes. 50. Looking for some elusive, chemistry that only he could see or appreciate, possibly.
Someone like Kubrick, I would imagine, would define to a hair how he'd want a shot framed.
Yeah, we'd have arguments about whether the crosshairs was on the center of the nose or slightly displaced in a wide shot, All of us had elected to do the film, and all of us knew Stanley well enough to know that's what the game was, and all of us were quite willing in the hopes that he would get precisely what he wanted, and all of us, including Nicholson and everybody else. But there were times when it, you know, it was a matter for consideration on another planet, whether the crosshair was here or here. I even once put a crosshairs made of tape on Shelley Duvall's nose and lined it up precisely with the crosshairs. For you folks out there who just see movies in the theater, the crosshairs are on the ground glass of the camera, and they indicate the center of the frame. Well, I lined up that crosshair with the fake one of gaffer's tape and held it very steadily, and then as the shot moved on, I moved mine away, and there were two in the frame, and hers always stayed right exactly where I wanted it. This is what you go get into, and you know, after take 40 in Great Britain in June, when you're doing winter scenes that are supposedly taking place in Colorado.
Have you ever told any directors that you thought their expectations were totally unrealistic and suggested ways that they should alter the shot they had in mind?
No, usually, to be quite honest, they have insufficient confidence that, you know, this thing will do, let's put it this way, we have learned to do things that they're not aware of yet, so usually it goes the other way. Usually you're saying, look, you sure you don't want to continue into this? Let me leap off the bow and swim ashore.
Someone like Barbara Streisand has a reputation for being willing to only be shot from certain angles. I know that you did some shooting for Yentl. Did you have to work with that, with the Steadicam? I don't know if she was in the shots that you did.
Quite a lot, yeah. But she's very good-humored about it. I mean, she conceives that she looks better from one angle than another, and I mean, I think she looks good from both angles, frankly, but you know, you've got to respect that feeling. And so the production endeavors to shoot her from the side that she likes, and it's not that difficult to do.
So it's not difficult to incorporate that in?
No, no.
Have you worked with actors who are pretty ordinary in real life, but they have a magic, a screen presence, once the camera's turned on?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, of course, I'm stymied to think who, but John Lithgow is one who just comes alive on camera.
What about Robert De Niro?
De Niro is a classic chameleon. I mean, De Niro on the street, you know, you wouldn't pay the slightest attention to, and he's electric on camera. And you look at it very carefully. I mean, I look, when you're using the Steadicam, you see the shot you're shooting through a little video monitor, a green monitor, sad to say, on the Steadicam. So I see scenes that I'm shooting, nude scenes or spectacles, it's all the same. I see this little strange green picture, and every now and then you look up and throw a glance at real life there, and somebody who is as magic as some of these people we've been talking about will light up that little screen, you know, and you look and you, my God, you get enthralled with what they're doing on that tiny little monitor with crosshairs at all, you know.
But you look up and
it
in
is
reality
real.
It's
yeah,
nothing.
It is real. I'll think a bit later, there are a couple others that just come alive on camera and who are basically can hide elsewhere.
Is there a director that you really felt you learned a lot from by working with them?
Strangely enough, George Miller, I worked with it. I did the tail end of Twilight Zone, a couple of episodes of Twilight Zone, and I had as much fun and learned as much watching George operate. He did Mad Max and The Road Warrior, you'll recall. And he's amazing. He's an absolutely wonderful director of people and actions. And also, there's something else. He does it all with a style, which is great. I'm just a really exciting character to be with. Absolutely a gentleman, keeps it all moving. And yet you're aware that, you know, it isn't a game to George, but it isn't the end of the world. He realizes he's still making a movie. You know, he keeps his perspective about it. The folks that are the most difficult to work with are those who take themselves and what they're doing so seriously that you can't keep your perspective intact. I mean, it's only a movie, after all, you know.
So are people using less cliché shots now with the Steadicam? You said initially people
By far, yeah.
Yeah, people would call you up initially to run up and down stairs.
Yeah, so it's quite fun.
What are some of the calls you get now?
Well, I get called to do, let's see, for an example, I worked on Falling in Love, which just came out, and I work on very few films in the last couple of years because I have been keeping my attention on the Skycam, but I have in my deal the opportunity to do a couple of good ones a year, so it would have been about 8 months, on Falling in Love called, and the shots were proceeding up the street just ahead of Streep, in a place where if you made a big production out of it and laid rails and so on, it happened to be on Fifth Avenue right in front of the Trump Tower, you would draw crowds that would be unmanageable. So we basically popped out of the shadows and made the shot before anybody was quite aware of what we were doing, and I like that. I like using it that way. Sad to say, or good to say, there was another production on the same block with a Steadicam with another gentleman who's one of the living masters operating for on a Mickey Rooney movie. So their crowd control would release people just as we were trying to stop people, and it all got very comical. And then Sidney Lumet showed up and wheeled in and backed his truck up and stole a shot on our permits, and Cotton Club was shooting up the street, and the commercial was like one of those days in New York where the whole world is a movie set. It was very funny. I even walked into the wrong camera truck because they were from the same company, and there are the cases for the Steadicam sitting on the tailgate just as I left mine, and I walk in and I open them up the cases, and I was on the wrong truck. It was Teddy Churchill's truck who was doing the Mickey Rooney film.
It must be easy to lose perspective when you're surrounded by that many movies.
Fun also, though, because we always used to say there should be one of these on every corner Steadicam. So we're getting there. We're getting there. It's a fun machine. I don't know if I've ever really expressed this properly, but it is the operating a film is intriguing, as you can imagine. And the operator is quite a deep character. I mean, he has a lot more to do than simply point the thing. But operating the film and doing the athletic routine of Steadicam, in which you place it in space as well, is fascinating. It's just about my most favorite thing to do.
You're privy to the plot and to the ending before anybody knows about the movie, and directors are sometimes very protective about their stories. Do you have to ever sign secrecy oaths, swearing that you'll never let on what happens at the end?
In one instance, I did,
For which movie? And tell us what happens at the end.
Well, it's long released, but let's see, what was it? It was it might have been Jedi, as a matter of fact. I think it was. I had to sign an agreement to keep all the proceedings secret on Jedi, because George didn't want anybody knowing, you know, what was going on and who did what to whom and who came back to life and who got frozen and so on.
Let me just ask you one question about Lucas and Spielberg. A lot of people think of them as people who've been spoiled by their own success and who are so obsessed with movies and have been out in the non-movie world so little that they actually are detached from reality. Do you think that that's true at all?
I don't know. It's easy to point at Spielberg and say, well, I mean, there's something, you know, somewhat juvenile about Indiana Jones and that whole conception. But, you know, Spielberg is very deliberately making that movie, and that movie works for a large percentage of the audience. I can't say that it's my favorite kind of movie, but I had a hell of a good time in Star Wars and in the first Raiders is one of my favorite films just to sit and look at, and I can easily do that. I love to just watch a film and let the magic work and, you know, do it all. I don't think the art was advanced particularly by Indiana Jones, but it did fine. People loved it, you know. Lucas and Spielberg are very serious about what they do, and they do it very well, you know, and it just doesn't gain the naysayers much to point and say, well, you guys have lost touch with it all. They have gained touch with, you know, several billion of the world's currency units. So they're in touch with, you know, at least several of the values that folks appreciate, you know.
My guest is Garrett Brown, who's the inventor of the Steadicam, which has been used for many, many, many movies, and he has shot many movies himself. And he's also the inventor of the Skycam, which is a brand new camera. Why did you want to go through this again with the Skycam? You have a very successful invention. It won the 1978 Academy Award for Technical Achievement. I'm referring to the Steadicam. It's a great success. Every director uses it, and they either hire you or hire someone else who you've trained.
Not every, but quite a few.
Most of them, okay. Yeah. And then you went through the whole thing all over again of inventing something brand new, having to introduce it and market it and train yourself on it. It must have been really difficult to start again.
Well, I don't know why I did it at this point. I've had many a moment when I thought that it was a mistake to have started this, to be honest, but not lately. Lately, I think that it was a great idea to have done it again. There were times when we almost gave up on it because it was terribly difficult to do, much by orders of magnitude more difficult than Steadicam.
Why don't you describe what it is, how it works?
Well, Skycam is a cams proliferate, but Skycam is an attempt to get even more freedom for where the lens can be, because the Steadicam operator is of necessity still in touch with the ground, at least. He has an amazing freedom laterally on the ground, and he can run around and so on. But I began to be intrigued by all that air up there, which I didn't have access to. I can get the lens up to about 8 feet, and then beyond that, it's terra incognita, you know. And I was sitting around pondering the problem that sports shooters have shooting football and so on, because all of their cameras are stuck on the borderline between the stadium and the air, this thin border area, you know, and therefore a camera works with an extremely long lens if it's way back up in the press box or up in the perimeter of the place. And the effect of a long lens is like looking through binoculars. You don't feel that you're there. You feel like you're sort of peeping in on what's happening, but you're not there physically. You don't feel close to it. And confusing things happen with these long telephoto lens shots. If you'll think of a typical shot of a football player, you know, going through the line seen telephoto, bodies pass in the foreground, soft focus. Bodies pass in the background. You don't see the holes open up. You just see his figure very clearly, but obscured by things as he runs along. And suddenly it's a mass of helmets and, you know, pads and legs kicking, and that's it, you know. Whereas, where would you like to be to see football? I mean, just one of the ways that I like to think about things is, suppose that the restrictions which we take for granted were eliminated. Where would you like to be? Where would you like that lens to be? Well, you know, it's easy. You'd want that lens to be in a little invisible helicopter that made no noise and couldn't, you know, cut the grass if it fell down. Just right over the quarterback's shoulder, wouldn't you? And you'd want to be able to go as fast as he could run and go anywhere in the field and look at anything you wanted to look at without creating a nuisance to yourself or having a big rotor blades, you know, causing anxiety among the players. And so I thought, well, that's very nice. Now, I wonder if there's any way to do that. And I thought about Mary Martin, the way she used to be hauled around on stage by stagehands. A couple invisible wires. The guy on the right, George, pulls hard, and off she goes to the right, and Sam lets out the cable and, you know, lets her go. If George and Sam both pull in, she goes up, doesn't she? So let's add a couple of more stagehands, you know. In fact, in the early days of the Skycam, we actually did fly the thing around as an experiment with four guys running around with the ropes, which came up through pulleys and down to the camera. And if you get the choreography just right, like little ninjas running around, it can be done. You know, these two guys run this way and those two run that way, and damned if the thing doesn't, you know, drift across. But clearly the way to do it is to have a computer which knows who, God, I got caught there, I said, who knows? Forgive me, oh computer. A computer which knows the dimensions of the space exactly, and which calculates thousands of times a second if the operator, the, you know, God of the computer, wants to go to the right at 20 miles an hour, where should the camera be, which is to say, how long should my wire be, this given motor, in the next thousandth of a second? Okay, it should be a quarter of an inch shorter. Each of these is a discrete event. Okay, now the next thousandth of a second, he's still going 20 miles an hour to the right. How short, how much shorter, how much more wire should I pull in? Okay, another quarter of an inch. And when those events happen that rapidly, they're to all effects continuous. So the operator has a big joystick, and he indicates which way he wants to go. If he wants to go forward, he pushes that stick down, and he's sitting up in the press box watching all this, like the ultimate video game, if you will. The computer reads the joystick. It consults its table of what size is everything, where am I now, what is the Euclidean hypotenuse of this imaginary triangle up to the pulley, and so on. Once for each of the four motors employed. You know, in a circle, endless circle. Motor one, okay, you should take in a quarter of an inch. Motor two, take in an eighth of an inch. Motor three, let out a quarter, blah, 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 blah. All going on at the speed of light. And that part seemed clear enough, and that was exciting. And then the most difficult part is back to my old game of camera stabilization, because that's a vile place for a camera, out and held on four wires jerking around, vibrations and wind and so on. And we had to bring the art of camera stabilizing forward quite a distance, I must tell you, to make this thing work, because the quality of the picture has got to be better than a helicopter shot, or it's basically useless for really fine work. I'm happy to say that that worked beyond our expectations, that we got into such a head of steam on stabilization that by the time we stopped and looked around and examined the results, the thing is amazing, quite amazing.
You've had to try to interest both television networks and movie directors in the use of the Skycam. At the same time, there have been a lot of problems to tune up in.
To say the least.
So yeah. What have some of the demonstrations been like for you? Nerve-wracking, I'm sure.
Nerve-wracking is right. It's almost impossible for me to imagine that I would have done this if I'd known in advance how scary some of it was. For example, we took it out on The Natural, just the prototype out on The Natural. And,
the movie, The Natural.
Yeah, the movie. With the arrangement that if we weren't happy with the way it was working, we would not tie up the main unit's time. We wouldn't shoot Redford and all the extras. We would just do a few inserts. And since we weren't in the way, just putting it up out there, they were quite happy to do that, so we did. And the first day out, I made an operator's mistake, a sky camera's mistake, if you will, and I said to somebody, the computer was in the shot up in the stands. I said, okay, unplug it and bring it down here. Well, that particular version, when it got unplugged, I'd forgotten that we had programmed into it a command that if you ever lose your information, if the data stops for some reason from the computer, what you should do is take up at 3/4 of the speed of the motors up to the point where you can't go any higher. We figured that would get it out of trouble in any event. And that fail-safe command went into effect just as one of my guys was about ready to grab the camera and put a new load of film on, and suddenly, zoom, it's gone. It flew up in the air and hung there in a sort of embarrassing wounded duck attitude until we could go around and restart all the data, you know. And I realized that 3/4 of its top speed is quite fast for something to leave the vicinity of someone. I mean, it went, it was gone. And I looked over at my trusty computer programmer, Larry Cohn, who was a very cool head, basically, but not used to showbiz. And I'd forgotten that, you know, I've been tempered and bloodied on, you know, hundreds of movies. These guys that I was working with, and I have some wonderful partners in this, you know, guys who do the engineering and the electronic engineering and the computer programming and so on. But for some of them, it was their first exposure to the pressure of a film set. And I looked over at Larry, who was trying to type in the new data, and his hands were shaking to a point where I could hardly move. Well, I feel for him. I mean, I have felt the pressure at times. For instance, we showed it early on to the Olympic Committee. You pointed out earlier that we have to get the networks and the directors to use it, but that has been the easy part. There are lots and lots of people that are enthused about using it. The problems have been strangely unexpected ones. We have to persuade people that own a stadium or the local fire department that it is safe, which makes sense. So there's a lot of engineering, you know, reports and things to show them that, yes, it's 5 times as strong as it needs to be, and no, it can't fall on anybody, and it's okay, and so on. We have to persuade athletic federations that it won't interfere with the play and the games. Now, this is becoming quite easy now because most of them have seen it on things like the Orange Bowl and the Army-Navy game and so on, and now all of a sudden they know all about it, and oh, yeah, that's fine. But before anybody had seen it, there was great concern. For instance, in the era when ABC was hoping to get it for the Olympics, they had to expose it to, you know, all the athletic federations so that they could judge and whether or not it would distract anybody or get in the eye line of somebody and so on and so on. So we're demonstrating it in the Coliseum, showing what it would look like at the finish line of the running track. But the goalposts were still in the Coliseum because they were in the football mode. And the goalposts, of course, wouldn't have been there in the Olympics. But I had to fly very close to them with a wire leading up to that corner just to get the camera into the finish line right beside the goalpost on the side. And after a while, I got distracted by something and somebody asked me a question and I tagged the top of the goalpost with the wire that leads to the SkyCam at 20 miles an hour, and it had enough force to bend the steel goalpost right around and bend it over in, like, you know, a pretzel shape. And I had a wild urge to bend it back with the SkyCam, but I did not succumb to that urge. But it, you know, was just very embarrassing. I said, now, you know, I tried to salvage the situation. I said, well, you see, you shouldn't let the inventor fly his own invention, and all these sort of mock humble, you know, nonsensical retractions of things, but it was embarrassing and it was frightening. And, you know, we've had power failures just before a game when the thing is, you know, its first football game, it was sitting on the field and somebody switched off a circuit breaker in the power to one of the motors, so it was functionally inert. And we had to quickly put into practice all the fail safes, all the, you know, emergency drills that we'd rehearsed with ring of girls scantily clad finishing off their, you know, twirling routine, and the player is about to come in, and here is this, you know, inert heap of junk sitting in the middle of the field. I can tell you that the cardiovascular system works because I made the acquaintance of every capillary in my body while that was going on.
What's an example of one of the most victorious moments that you've had with the Skycam so far? One of the, like, you know, greatest shots that you've been able to achieve with it?
Well, we did an amazing, wonderful shot on Birdie. The picture was fraught with difficulties for us, but the equipment got rained on the first night out, and we learned something about cranes, that when the pulleys are held up by large cranes, and they're hydraulic cranes, that they sink slowly. And Alan Parker was doing a shot that was 6 inches above the ground, and the crane sank 8 inches, so we crashed our priceless Panavision specially built lightest in the world camera on the ground at 20 miles an hour, and endless other problems, just sort of bedeviled by problems on that picture. But the shots that were produced, and some of which are in Birdie, despite Alan's rather vindictive rage at not getting everything he wanted, are wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And it was just, you know, incredibly thrilling to me to see what had been done here, impersonating a, you know, a bird's flying point of view. Alan has rather a worm's eye view of all of this at this point, but
what are some of the images that you had in your mind of how you wanted the Skycam to have a point of view of flying?
Well, you must know, of course, thought about the moving camera quite a lot in a lot of particulars. I mean, I have imitated many kinds of motion in my career using the Steadicam. For instance, I used it to produce the motion of turbulence in an inert airplane set in Twilight Zone, and that involved thinking what you really see when a plane is turbulent and what it should look like and so on. I've made the points of view of many things, creatures large and small. But the idea of a camera that can fly appealed to me from the beginning. I mean, the idea that, you know, with great control that you can fly around through a set, I love that point of view. I mean, I don't know if most people feel the same way I do about it. I mean, I've always wondered what it looks like to a bird, not so much what it feels like, but, you know, what it looks like. I love the potential visual idea of flying through things. And I've seen some things with this thing that just fill me with delight. Even on sporting events, you see shots that have never been seen before that are either color shots, you know, atmospheric shots where you bring the team in and then pull up, you know, 400 feet, up 200, back 500. At 20 miles an hour, the magnitude of this, if you're used to a crane shot that tops off at 27 feet, is heart-stopping. We did some rock videos. We did a Lionel Richie Pepsi commercial, which will debut on the Grammys in a couple of weeks. You must see this. And we did some shots on that are just beyond anything that I imagined, because the thing has more grace and style than I imagined it would. I must confess that I loved the idea of what it might do, but I didn't see it big enough in my mind. I still saw it as being slightly mechanical somehow, and it has spirit. It has a wonderful grace, and you can imagine what it feels like to lay a hand on the stick and haul it back and see in the monitor what the camera is seeing yourself roaring away, you know.
Well, I think that the Skycam is just the opposite of the Steadicam for you, because the Steadicam, when you operate it, you have to strap it on and run around carrying it around with you.
Oh, yes, you don't get tired with the Skycam.
You have the Skycam, you're just sitting down and moving the joystick.
You're there in a sense. I mean, because it's a very fine manipulation of the stick. I mean, you are sort of there, but you're not there. I mean, it's the ideal thing to invent for the increasingly elderly Steadicam operator.
Do you have flying dreams?
I used to, as a matter of fact. One recurrent one, yeah.
Do you think that's connected with your interest in getting the flying point of view with a camera?
Well, now that you mention it, I'm certain of it, and I always have been certain of it.
Because that's the only time for me that I really consider that a lot, about what it would look like if you're flying or up in the air, and have these, like, weird flying dreams, which I guess a lot of people have.
I used to have one that was very graphic, which is related to something else, actually, but in which involved the idea that the air had a certain thickness and that I could run down the street and sort of plow my way through it as if it was sort of like going through glycerin or Jell-O or something like that. But I never got much higher than the first set of telephone wires, and I'd usually get hung up in those. Yes, there it is, wires, the recurrent theme, yes, yes.
The Steadicam brought with it a kind of set of cliched reactors by some directors who could only envision the Steadicam operator running up the stairs with it and doing things like that. Do you expect that the Skycam, before it really comes into its own, is going to have all these cliched suggestions for it, that you're going to be getting
calls for
the most obvious things in the whole world?
We will inflict on viewers endless repetitions of the fly-away 300-foot theme.
What's that?
Well, you start in close on somebody, and you pull back 300 feet and up hundreds of feet in the air. I mean, you'll get totally sick of all that. That's not where the money is, and I use that expression in the film sense. The money, meaning what's important, is, you know, back to the original concept, where do you really want to be for what's going on here? But we will have a lot of fun for a while until we wear it out with the idea of flying away, you know, coming in on a crowd. The end of the Orange Bowl, the coach was being congratulated and lifted up on everybody's shoulders and so on of the winning team. And we were right there in front of him. You wouldn't have known it wasn't a handheld camera in the crowd, except it was very stable. Thank you very much. And then didn't it pull away and circle around this crowd, you know, seeing the magnitude of it and seeing on all sides the people leaving and swarming down into the thing and then pulling way up into the sunset and seeing the... It was grand.
Is there a movie that you'd really like to do now with the Skycam, a kind of movie or a kind of shot that you look forward to doing with it?
Well, as a matter of fact, if somebody does a remake of Peter Pan, I would love to work on that. And there's been some talk that a very well-known person might do that. We almost were on a picture the other day that I thought, well, that's extraordinary. Sort of every case is its own case, isn't it? You know, every shot has its own requirements. On Slugger's Wife, we did a lot of shots on the film that are not, and this is thank you to Caleb, the shooter, and to Ashby, not your cliche Skycam shots, just using it to get the lens where they wanted it instantaneously on the baseball field. And I like that kind of work. When you think of a film you'd like to make, the mind does run to the spectacular shot that you sort of dream of. But I have to keep reminding myself the money, quote, is in, you know, what it does well and how quickly it does it. And in this very mercantile atmosphere that prevails with filmmaking, you know, can you get the shot faster, better, more reliably, and, oh, yes, by the way, better looking than something else?
Well, how does it compare to a helicopter? Do you think that people are anxious to get rid of helicopters for movie shots?
Well, the helicopters are in somewhat less favor since the disaster on John Landis's film, but the helicopter, of course, is noisy and makes a lot of wind and does not allow you to put the lens right in, right there on somebody, and clearly would not be useful in an athletic thing or something like the Lionel Richie thing, which is, we were on the back lot, I'll give you an example, at Universal in the New York street with him on a stage in the middle of the street, lots of lights all around, and 3,000 extras. And the camera can circle around Richie very close, you know, seeing all the crowds as he works the crowd, spinning around on stage, and then pull away and up and back, you know, again, hundreds of feet. I couldn't do that with a helicopter without, you know, giving him a haircut. So.
You had said that for the Steadicam, there's some Hitchcock shots that you would have loved to do with a Steadicam to work on some of his movies. Is there any classic film sequences that you would like to reshoot but with a Skycam?
I'd love to work the chariot race in Ben-Hur, for example, with the Skycam. I'd love to shoot the scene in Gone with the Wind when the wounded are laid out all in that courtyard. At the kind of prices we charge, I'll cheerfully shoot anything over again.
How has the experience of actually developing the Skycam, marking it, and using it compared to the expectations that you had when you started?
I wasn't able in the beginning, Terry, to see much further into this one. It was almost a compulsive sort of behavior to start this project. I was afraid of it. I mean, I was afraid that it would be long and, you know, difficult. I was afraid of things that haven't turned out to be true, for instance. I was afraid that Oh, crowds on the site would be annoyed at something whizzing around. They appear to love it. It's quite intriguing, and it doesn't get in anybody's eyeline. I was afraid that athletes would be tormented by it, and the losing team would say, "Get that thing out of here," you know. I was afraid of the particulars of that sort, as well as the mysteries of trying to start a business and, you know, and make it work. So far, we've been somewhat more successful at making the camera work than the business work, and I guess that's to be the progression of things, because the camera, now that it works very well, will foster a very successful business, I feel sure. But not being a businessman or a skilled manager and so on, I've learned a few things the hard way that I never foresaw, you know, making money arrangements and, you know, spending it wisely and, you know, managing people intelligently and so on. So I can't say that those things were in my mind when I started, and nor did I realize how difficult it would be. I mean, the thing has been brutal, frankly. I used to be twice as tall as I am now. I didn't used to smoke, so it's had its toll, you know.
Do you think you'll try something like this again? Are you anxious now to just...
Well, I have another one underway.
Oh, no, really?
Oh, it's a wonderful gadget, of which I cannot speak, so we might as well leave that one be.
But you'd go through this all again, start all over again?
Yeah, it's a habit.
You can operate it, too, when it's...
Oh, yeah.
I just want to ask you a couple of things that are unrelated to the cameras, but I know a lot of our listeners know you, in addition to your film work, to the commercials that you've done that are really like the talk of the industry, and they're for Molson's and for American Express and for WIOQ here in Philadelphia. And I guess what interests me, in addition to the style that you and Ann Wynn have achieved, the kind of comic sketch, improvised style, is that you're never seen. You know, even on the TV commercials, they never see the faces, and I'm not sure that even the people being shot aren't extras, just with your voices.
Oh, yes, we use other bodies on the TV spot.
Why don't you want to be seen?
Well, the thing is, it became clear to us that everyone who is interested in those spots, and there seems to be quite a constituency out there that is intrigued with Anne, at least, has a mental picture of what she looks like, and it doesn't seem intelligent to disabuse them of that mental picture. Why change it? I mean... And surgery was very successful, and she looks quite spectacular, but we don't think that anybody ought to have a specific image to look at. For instance, very quickly along in Stiller and Mira's career, on camera they went, and now you're forced to think of the way they look, for better or worse, when you hear Stiller and Mira. I was more intrigued with Ann Mira, nothing against the way she looks, but I had a different mental picture of her, and I wasn't real pleased to have it switched to her present appearance, which is fine, again, I say, with all... humility and due respect and so on. But Anne just decided, you know, nuts. No one will know what I look like. And we've been interviewed, are about to be done, I think, on Entertainment Tonight in a few places. And the way they'll do it is like the commercials, in fine details of hands and coffee cup and feet shuffling and fingers on control board and so on. We've been interviewed in silhouette, very humorous. You can be very expressive with a silhouette, I found.
Do you want to make your own movie sometime?
Yeah, I think you and I talked about that once when we were here. I'm interested in a feature film business that originates in this town. I think it's a great town to make movies in. We're kind of waiting till things settle down a little bit. We're looking for properties and beginning to think about it. The business of filmmaking intrigues me less than films. The business of shooting intrigues me less than what shot and how you get it and so on. I like comedies, obviously, and I think my tastes are fairly well known, so we'll shoot a black comedy of some sort here.
Listen, I wish you success with the Skycam and with the third camera that you're...
That one isn't a camera, fortunately.
Oh, it's not a
camera.
That's, okay.
Something else.
Okay, yeah. Well, I won't ask, since you won't tell anyways. But I wish you the best with all of that and with all your Steadicam movie work as well. And I'm delighted that you were able to come back and talk with us again.
It's thanks.
Something I've been
it was
wanting
fun,
to do
Terry.
For a
good
time.
To see you.
Thanks
again.
A lot for being here. My guest has been Garrett Brown, who invented the Steadicam in 1978. He got an Academy Award for technical achievement for that invention. He's not only the inventor, but he's one of the best operators of the Steadicam as well. And he's shot sequences for many movies, including Return of the Jedi and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom recently. And he now recently invented the Skycam, which is a camera that hovers from a few inches to a few hundred feet in the air, can travel up to like 25 miles an hour up, down, and across. And that's being used for sporting events and movies.
And delivering a cup of coffee all the way across the stadium.
We did that once. It's like having a little robot with eyes, right? Garrett Brown lives in Philadelphia, although he spends a lot of time on location for various movies and sporting events as well. And thank you again for being with us.
Thanks.